So let me transition to Jason Camelot. Jason is professor of English and sound studies at Concordia in Montreal. His critical works include Phonopoetics, The Making of Early Literary Recordings, Style and the 19th Century British Critic, and the co-edited collections Canlit Across Media, Unarchiving the Literary Event with Catherine MacLeod, and Language Acts, Anglo-Quebec Poetry, 1976 to the 21st Century. He is also author of four collections of poetry: Attention All Typewriters, The Animal Library, The Debaucher, and What the World Said. And as I mentioned in the first remarks, he is also director of The Spoken Web, which is a Shirk-funded partnership that focuses on the history of literary sound recordings and the digital preservation and presentation of collections of literary audio. So welcome, Jason, and I guess you will have some sound to share with us.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, Miranda. Thanks, Evelyn, for that beautiful reading. I'm really, really happy to be here. I'm just going to jump right into it. Yeah. So as Miranda mentioned, I wanted to just start with a video invitation. So I'm going to play a clip of about a minute and 30 seconds. That is the opening of a podcast that I made with my colleague, Catherine MacLeod, also the co-editor of that collection that Miranda mentioned. That we made, I can't believe it's already 3 months ago, but it was really in the first weeks that we, that COVID-19 really sent us into isolation. And the podcast is really sort of exploring our listening environments, how our sound environments and how our listening practices have changed as a result of this new way of living. And the podcast really explores the question through the question of moving our teaching online, which a lot of us were doing at the time. There's a section talking about David Anton, who is a talk poet, and whose poetry, in a sense, depended upon performing before an audience. And so we were sort of thinking, well, what did that mean that we were listening to him when we can't have audiences anymore in that traditional sense? And then also a lot about sort of what it meant to move poetry readings online in the first instance. So here's a little clip from that. And we're going to be having a conversation sort of revisiting the question next week, and you're all invited to join. So I'll share my screen.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right.
to normal, public health.
Hello, how are you doing?
I should be able to hear you. Oh, I think I have the wrong.
Stay home as much as possible.
So Clara says she can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, good.
Stay home. Keep at least 2 meters from each other.
My lover believed there had to be a point at which reality
Oh my gosh, the red one on my favorite.
I'm just gonna pause because my internet just said something about, I think we got a little offset.
From each other. Stay home from each other.
But what I've been noticing is that I don't want to be listening to things, and I've been feeling mostly overwhelmed.
That's the first words in music show that went online. Right there.
I love that.
That was in March, so pretty early on, I guess. Yeah. And of course, we had to make it at home, so we had to work, create studios at home. You know? Yeah. So I'm going to jump right into the reading, and I'll stick with that theme of sort of listening with and without visuals, because the poem I want to open with, it's from the last book that I published, What the World Said. It may appear backwards, I'm not sure, on your screen, because I'm not sure if I'm in mirror mode. But I'm going to read this one. It's quite easy to produce a kind of acousmatic voice experience on Zoom, right? Because you can just turn your video off. And this is a poem that lends itself well to that kind of experience. So I'm just going to unvideo myself for this one poem, and then I'll be back. This poem is called Where the Voice Goes. Where does the voice go? You ask this question, dear listeners, and you are right to ask it. Most justified. Well, what shall I say next? Welcome. Welcome is what I shall next say to you. Welcome, dear listeners, to this, the answer to your question. Welcome to the poem entitled, Where the Voice Goes, an Answer. How very convenient for you. All right. So on the theme of distance, I decided I would go back to my first book. This reading sort of got me to dig out all my books. And so this was 20 years ago, I can't believe. The Animal Library was the first book that I published. And it's a lot, like many first books, it's a lot about family and family lore. And this poem was based on a story that was told to me, and it sort of circulates in my family, about some cousins who survived, Eastern European Jews who survived the Second World War in Berlin without ever leaving, by running a bordello. So this poem is called My Last Bordello Cousins. And the reason it links up with the themes tonight is that Aveline had started her reading with the telephone. It's sort of about telecommunications, but in this sense, sort of trying to find a telecommunications portal back in time to talk to cousins I'll never know, obviously. My Last Bordello Cousins. I'm visiting my family who survived the war in Berlin. How is it possible? The Berlin Bordello relatives. My Last Bordello Cousins. I carry a letter of introduction, random numbers on azure flesh, and step in wait of strange noises. It says, I have come for your lesson in fear. I am entering the chambers now of my lost bordello family, like the silent visitor of a thankless secret opera. On either side of me, my knick-knack lineage in display cases on blonde satin cushions, carefully arranged. Pierced luxury ornaments and black shoe straps, a medieval belt much gemmed for the mouth, one false erotic buttock mole in a pink velvet box. If willed to me, I will cherish them all. From the central core, I hear live body percussion and a loving voice that beckons me, come. I foresee a toast to our shared blood, a blessed artery spectacle in a whole bone cup. Death teams, hurrah, instead of an impossible l'chaim. In the empty salon on a tattered ottoman, the red vagina telephone glows and purrs. Is this how we shall finally meet, my last bordello cousins? Hello? How is it possible? My mouth is now a circle for you. Oh, my cousins, I do not begrudge you the oily tombstone caress of hell. All right. So for the rest of the reading, I'm going to read some poems from a new manuscript that I'm more or less done with. I have a few things I'm tinkering with. It's one of a few that I've been working on for a long time. And the title of this project is called Vlarf. And it's basically, that translates as Victorianist Flarf. So you may be familiar with the Flarf movement. And in a way, I had a conversation with a colleague of mine who's a modernist scholar, Mike Goldston, a while back, and we were talking about FLARF because I was in San Francisco when some early FLARF stuff was happening when I was a grad student, and I was at those readings and performances, and I said, I'm going to write a Victorian FLARF book, the way I define Victorian flarf, so vlarf refers to a form of Victorianist flarf in which expressions of sentiment that may have become unfamiliar, unacceptable, uncool since modernism are pursued by engaging with Victorian texts and generic forms using techniques that include erasure, cut-up, bourrime, emulation, adaptation, reboot, mimicry, abhorrence, cringe, and love. So I'm going to read a few of these, and I'm going to read a few shorter ones. Well, they're not that short, but you know, shortish ones. And then I'll start reading one really long one, which is really a 20-minute poem unto itself. But it's one of the dramatic monologues in the book, sort of a remake of a dramatic monologue. But I'll start with the first poem in the book. It's called Lost Days. And it's a bourrime sonnet using rhymes. Bourrime means you just take the rhymes at the end of the lines of a sonnet and you write a new poem using those same rhyme words. So you're basically retrofitting rhyme words onto a new poem. So this is Lost Days. And these rhymes come from Dante Gabriel Rossetti poem of the same title. Lost Days. The Victorian period is alive today. The sandwich men are lurking in the streets. They invented new machines for thrashing wheat, hammers for pummeling men back into clay, systems to guarantee that workers pay with lacerated hands and blistered feet. Victorian children learn to cheat properly, to apologize always when battling other children to the death. A was for asylum, B for bricks, C for Crimean War. Victorian breath was just like ours, but lacy. Believe me when I say they prayed with words like saith. Their deeds shall live on for eternity. And I'm going to read a couple of erasure poems. I wrote about 20 erasure poems from the works of John Ruskin, actually, and especially from his books that he wrote on minerals, plants, animals, often geared towards the education of children. So again, as you're probably familiar with the technique, you keep a few words from a page, and from that you build something else. So here are just a couple of those. This one's called Flowers. Flowers. The flower's death is an offering, like dust falling into zones of fire. In summer, we come upon the gifts of bracts and stalks and tori and calyces and corollas and discs and stamens and pistils. Take that cluster of bog heather bells, bunch them into a star. They can only be drawn as they grow. Take the dark contortion, the pale wasting, the quiet closing of the brown bells of the ling. Take this foretaste of death flowers, their heavy wavering like the gait of human bats. Take this tiny red poppy, all silk and flame, burning in its own scarlet cup. If you offer a small bouquet of four, one pair is always smaller than the other. Take this humble host of green syllables, familiarly Englished, into nectar. Take them from me, gently, and then cast the severed leaves away. And I'll do one more of these, and then I'll just jump into that longer dramatic monologue that I mentioned. So, and there's sometimes some overlap of language from poem to poem. So this one's called Living Devices. I believe that somewhere I have already observed creatures tenderly bound. I can't as yet find out. Meanwhile, I will look at them and see the mystery of distance. But how did they die is the first thing I want to know about them. Take this sandy vase with its foretaste of death flowers and the tracery of human bats. And then, at last, with my own broken memories of snakes, I will hope for the harvest and coals on my head. Okay, so Miranda, I don't know if you've been keeping track of time, because I haven't, but it would be good to know.
Well, we're at about 7 o'clock, so maybe just a few more minutes.
Okay, so I'll read the first section, or as much as I can of this first section of this poem. There is a reboot of some of my favorite Victorian poems in this collection. This one I've been working on. There's a kind of remake of The Fruit Man, although there's no way I can compete with Christine Rossetti. But this one is a dramatic monologue that's kind of a rewriting of Johannes Agricola in Meditation, which is a Browning dramatic monologue, but also really plays a lot upon the Victorian fascination with anthropomorphizing animals. Okay, so this is called Fudge in Entropy. And I'll just read as much as I can, maybe a few minutes of this. Part one, lines crossed out. Hi, I'm Fudge, a guinea pig. As if you couldn't tell. Not long-haired, just regular-haired. How did you get here? Do you like Nava's room? I like it, but it has gotten a bit lonely. Are you shy? Anyhow, this little blank notebook I'm nibbling on was originally given to Dad, my owner, by the painter, Betty Goodwin, when he went to visit her in her studio sometime back in the 1990s. It's very small for a human notebook, like the size of my food bowl, only not heart-shaped, but rectangular. Black wrapped cardboard cover with red corners, lined pages inside. Made in China, I think. Cheap, but small, which was the reason for the little gift. She gave it to him to prove a point about the impact of scale upon artistic process. In this case, the impact of the size of Dad's medium, paper sheet, notebook, on how he was using words. My dad owner is a poet. In that dream, he brought the painter poems to read, to look at. The painter showed Dad what she thought of the poems. She didn't read them as he would have expected. She didn't read them for meaning. She read them as lists of words and phrases, some powerful, others distracting. She worked on the words by taking a sheet of tracing paper, covering his poems, and crossing out all of his words that got in the way of the emotion she was seeking. She felt that some words could get in the way, crowd out the potency of other more powerful words and phrases. These words are too crowded, she said, looking at one of his verbose pieces. There is deadly overcrowding, she said. She didn't say much more, but then she engaged with the words in front of him, crossing some out to free others to breathe, she said. It was a vivid gesture. She didn't explain what she was doing, but he could see her interact with certain words, and he could see the results of her annihilation. She crossed out whole words, whole lines, whole pages. It was like, whoa. The rationale of her crossing out was legible in small quivers around her eyes and mouth. The quivers stood in for any explanation she might have provided in words. My own opinion is the quivers were the effect of energy newly released from the words she had transformed by murdering other adjacent ones. My owner, Dad, the poet, saw what she was doing, and he understood it meant that his poems could no longer mean as he had intended them to mean. His poems once were too crowded. Now that had to stop. The painter would make it stop. The overcrowding in his poems were not fatal to people or to other creatures. Thanks be to God. Amen. Yes, I'm Jewish. Yes, there are Jewish guinea pigs. There are more of us than you might think. No, I don't look Jewish. I get that all the time. But really, what does a Jewish guinea pig look like? I'm not Orthodox or anything, but I identify. I'm sort of an atheist, but I identify with my Jewishness culturally. You don't want to know what they sometimes do to guinea pigs. No, you really don't want to know. I'm very privileged. I can sit here with a fresh green bean in my hands and talk to you about art and poetry. So I'm just going to stop there. It goes on and on, and he loses a pal, and you know, there's all other kinds of stuff that happens, but it gives you a sense of Vlarf, what Vlarf's all about. Yeah. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Jason, very much. And I realize you've tapped into a lot of things that I've been thinking about, but I'll hold that until later. I'd like to talk about freeing words.